Pete Bisson is with the Forest Service in Olympia, Washington. He leads an aquatic research team in the Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station. So he worked as an aquatic biologist for the Weyerhaeuser Company for 21 years prior to joining the Forest Service in 1995. And his research has included stream habitats and food webs, riparian zone management, and a variety of conservation issues related to aquatic ecosystems. He holds affiliate faculty appointments here at the University of Washington, Oregon State University, and the University of Idaho, and has served on two National Academy of Sciences committees, one on Pacific salmon and the other on watershed management. And he's currently vice chair of the Independent Scientific Review Panel for the Northwest Power Conservation Council. That's a mouthful.
That it is.
Which provides guidance to fish and wildlife recovery in the Columbia River Basin. And this morning he's going to talk about climate change and fish in the Pacific Northwest, study of the Snoqualmie River Basin. Pete.
Thank you, Bob. Can you all hear me okay in the back? Okay, good. A little bit of background to what this talk is about. Earlier in 2008, the Forest Service, realizing that it's one of its mandates was to produce more than just timber, realized that one of its most important and strategic natural resources was water. Something like a third of the nation's drinking water flows from national forests, and it's actually a pretty big deal. And in terms of long-term strategic value, our water supplies will become increasingly important in the 21st century. My guess is by the end of this century, water is going to be a lot more important than oil. But in any case, the agency had a mandate to develop a national policy on water. And of course, one of the things they were very much interested in is what are the likely effects of climate change on water going to be. So they convened like all agencies do, they put together a committee or a task force to work on the issue and drafted a water policy. And one of the assignments that came to me was to come up with a case study. And they said, well, make it have to do with the Forest Service water and throw some fish in there because we know fish are really important where you are. So I cast about to look for some good places to do a case study. And one of the most important resources regionally surely is the Climate Impacts Group here at the university. It's really without equal here in the Pacific Northwest. And the work that they've done has been extremely important in keeping us abreast of what the current trends are and what the future trends might be. The graphic on the left is the most recent draft of the Climate Impacts Group future predictions for climate change. It's still in draft form. It's a couple months old, but you can get it on the web, and it's huge. It's almost 800 pages long, but there's a lot of really good stuff in there. So if you're interested in getting into the topic some more, I encourage you to go to their website and take a look at that report. On the right is a graph of the predicted change in air temperature over the next 100 years. Here we are now to right in the middle, and the various colored zones in the graph in the end of the graph to the right correspond to different future climate models for future change. But in any case, you can see that they're all predicting some fairly significant increases by the end of the century. Also, why did I finally wind up selecting the Snoqualmie River? Well, first of all, the headwaters of the Snoqualmie are unregulated, which means there aren't any dams in the system in the upper Snoqualmie. The Forest Service is the predominant land manager. There are some other landowners lower down in the system, and we're talking the upper Snoqualmie above Snoqualmie Falls. It's a very large wilderness area, so it's a good place to kind of look at as a reference or baseline for what's been going on with climate in an area that hasn't received a tremendous amount of development. Yeah, you got the ski area at the top, and there has been some logging in it in the past, but for the most part, it's a designated wilderness, so it's a pretty good reference site. And the other thing is that it has a very nice system of gauging stations that the U.S. Geological Survey has operated for years. So we've got some very good weather-related long-term databases. Here's a King County map showing the headwater areas, and you can see, if you're not already familiar with it, that the Upper Snoqualmie has the North Fork, the Middle Fork, and the South Fork. Here's the town of Snoqualmie. Their falls are right there. The city of North Bend is right there. But most of it is mountainous area that is largely undeveloped. This is the network of gauging stations that currently exist in the Snohomish River Basin. Again, the Snoqualmie is at the southern end of the Snohomish Basin. The other main fork, of course, is the Skykomish at the northern end. And they're all pretty well gauged, and that's really, they have to be, because flooding, particularly in the lower Snohomish, is almost an issue almost every year. In a nutshell, this is what the basin looks like. The very headwaters areas tend to be dominated by fairly steep cascade streams. The middle reach are plain bed, and boulder-dominated riffles. And, of course, the lower end is meandering, often sandy bottom, river channel network through the floodplain and the ag land areas. Of course, the defining feature in the system is Snoqualmie Falls. All of the production of salmon and steelhead, the anadromous salmon, takes place below the falls. There have been occasional efforts to trap and haul salmon or steelhead above the falls, but for the most part, that doesn't happen. This is the end of the line for most of the anadromous species. Above the falls are all resident fishes, but nevertheless, what goes on in the headwaters has a big impact on the fish populations down below, because that's where the water comes from. So very quickly, these are the casting characters. The Snoqualmie has a fairly complete set of pretty much, except for one, all except for sockeye, it's got pretty much all the salmon and trout that people are worried about in the area. Beginning with Chinook salmon, which are currently listed as threatened, coho salmon, which National Marine Fisheries Service currently considers a species of concern, and if the trends continue, this is probably going to wind up with formal Endangered Species Act protection one of these decades. Chum salmon, which currently are relatively healthy in the system and fairly abundant. Pink salmon, and some of you may have seen this picture if you haven't. This is the world's record pink, which was caught a couple years ago, a.k.a. Humpzilla. It was caught in the Skykomish, just over the ridge from the Snoqualmie. But the pink populations in the Snohomish River Basin are in pretty good shape right now, probably the largest in central Puget Sound. Steelhead are the ocean-going form of the rainbow trout, are currently listed as threatened. Coastal cutthroat trout actually have relatively healthy populations at the current time. And then finally, bull trout, which is a species of one of the Northwest's only native char species, are listed as threatened. So about two-thirds of the salmon and trout in the Snoqualmie Basin are under some level of Endangered Species Act protection now. So what I'd like to do for much of the balance of the talk is compare the results and predictions that the Climate Impact Center has made for Puget Sound in general with this particular piece of real estate, the Snoqualmie, and see how they match up, given that the expectation is that you won't get a perfect fit with all the predictions in any one place. But for the most part, I think what we'll see here is that the Snoqualmie and over the last 50 or so years has conformed to what the Climate Impacts Group has stated has occurred and is likely to occur in the future. And, of course, the number one thing is that temperature is getting warmer, and what they believe is that the trends in the winter season and daily minimum temperatures have been the largest. So the minimum temperatures are going up, and, of course, the air temperatures are going up. I'm not expecting anybody to see this, especially from the back, but this is a month-by-month set of graphs of the mean monthly, the mean daily averages by month for the last 55 years at Snoqualmie Falls. January's up there and so forth on down to December here. And you can see there are some of the graphs that show slight increases or decreases. This next graph is a lot easier to understand. It simply looks at the slope of the best fit regression line to each one of those graphs plotted by month. And rather surprisingly, we see some of the largest increases in temperature occurring in January, in the middle of winter, and in the middle of summer. So both winter and summer are getting warmer. There are a couple of interesting anomalies here. First of all, we go from a rather marked increase in temperature that at Snoqualmie Falls in December to a fairly minor increase. You go from a high increase in January to a very moderate increase in February. And interestingly enough, a decrease in temperature in December. I don't know what the reason for that is. There doesn't seem to be any obvious reason for that, but it actually will have an effect on one of the subsequent graphs that I'm going to show, which has to do with discharge. Nevertheless, these are just plots of basically the mean daily average temperatures by month. The Climate Impacts Group was suggesting that the winter season variability might be greater. And in fact, on a temperature basis, it is. The cool season has a higher level of variation than the warm season here. And these coefficient of variation numbers are actually not that high. Wait till we get to precip and discharge. Then we'll really start seeing some high variability. But very clearly, the warm season months show a relatively low level of average variation, and the cool season temperatures are more variable, thus a little less predictable. Climate Impacts Group concludes that cool season precipitation variability has increased. So we just looked at temperature. Now we're going to go to precip. Let's see what happens here. Here's a graph of, I guess it's total monthly precipitation in January and in July. Again, for the last 55 years, you can see a decrease in January and basically a flat level of precip in July. Although the prediction or the conclusion that they made that variability is increased during the winter doesn't really jump out at you from this graph. It's highly variable pretty much over the whole period of record. And in fact, if you look at the slope of the trend of precipitation by month, and this is a bit surprising because a lot of the climate models are predicting that we're actually going to have slightly warmer, wetter winters. What we've seen in the Snoqualmie is quite a drop in precipitation in January, February, even in December. And the only times of the year that we've actually seen an increase in precipitation over the last half century have been in the transitional time from cool to warm, in other words, March, April, and May, particularly in May, and correspondingly the transitional period from warm to cool. So we've seen a really big increase in precipitation in November, followed by, and this is really kind of odd, followed by a decline in precipitation in December, which is sort of an interesting, kind of fine scale observation. If you look at the precipitation by month, we see just the reverse of what we saw for temperature. Whereas temperature variability is least in the summer and most in the winter, it's just the opposite in terms of precipitation. Look at the scale on the coefficient of variation axis. It's quite large, quite a bit more variable than it is for temperature. But what this says is that rainfall during the summertime in the Snoqualmie Basin has been more variable and less predictable in the summer than it has in the wintertime. Here's another one conclusion that has gotten a lot of press, and it certainly is the case, and that is the snowpack has declined, particularly at the elevation range that we see in the upper Snoqualmie, the range of about 2,000 to 5,000 feet. The April 1st snow water equivalent has declined, and the timing of peak runoff has shifted. So how did this play out from the Snoqualmie? Here's a graph of the total snowfall at Snoqualmie Pass from 1950 to 2006. This was done by one of my colleagues, Steve Wanzel, showing a pretty apparent decline in snow at up there at Snoqualmie Pass. Here's the runoff pattern over that, basically over about the same time interval. And what we're seeing is that in March, there's an increase. The trend is for increased runoff discharge in March, a slight increase in April, but in May and June, the runoff trends have been clearly going down. What that says is that over the last 50 years, we're seeing earlier runoff, and the late spring runoff that we would normally be having now has been going down. And I wouldn't be surprised if you went out to the river today and think, boy, this looks really low for this time of year. If you look at the slope of the discharge trend over time, again, what we see is a slight increase in discharge in March. Again, that trend may be due to earlier snow melt, and then a second and even larger increase in discharge in November. That's probably due to the fact that we're, for whatever reason, we're getting much greater, or not much, but significantly higher levels of precipitation then. And look at the difference here. See this large decline in discharge in December? That might possibly relate to the lower temperatures that we've seen up there. In other words, what's happening in November is instead of falling as snow, most of the precip is falling as rain and running off quickly. In December, where for whatever reason the temperatures have been getting a little cooler at Snoqualmie, there's an abrupt shift, so a lot of the precipitation then falls as snow and is held up in the snowpack until the spring runoff. So overall, though, what we're seeing is decreased and not increased winter flows. I mean, one of the predictions is we're going to have warmer, wetter winters. But in terms of the trend over the last 50 years at Snoqualmie, we're actually seeing a decline in winter flows and also a decline in midsummer flows. Now, one thing I would like to point out to you is these are mean daily discharge values. Just leaving aside the best fit regression line for each of these, look at the very lowest level of flow that you see in the river. Over the last 50 years, that floor, that rock bottom flow that you see in the Snoqualmie has gradually been declining. Now, I think that's going to have a big impact for the fish that live there, because what that does, in effect, is it squeezes the fish into a much smaller area. So that brings us to the fish. The climate impacts group suggested that temperature increases in stream flow are probably going to be the two most important climate-related conditions that are going to affect the fish. It's probably going to have a significant impact on the cold water species, that is salmon and trout, and that it will be expressed both during the cool period and the warm period. In the summertime, low flows and high temperatures are going to be a problem for juvenile growth and survival and adult migration. And in the wintertime and early spring, changes in the timing of peak flow may increase the vulnerability of fish to floods and affect their ability to survive their passage to the ocean. Now, in terms of what I found in the Snoqualmie, I'll try to relate the trends to what I think would be the most likely impacts on the different fish species. Elevated winter temperatures. What will happen there is that will accelerate the rate of development of the eggs when they're in the gravel, and most of these are fall spawning species except for steelhead and cutthroat, which are spring spawners. So that means that Chinook, coho, chum, pink, and bull trout, they're all fall spawners, will develop quicker and emerge from the gravel sooner than they normally do. This earlier emergence, which is likely to have already passed, I'm guessing the peak of the emergence was last month, is going to increase the vulnerability of fry to late winter storms, which could essentially flush the fish out of the basin. However, coming up out of the gravel earlier can be a blessing because it gives you a head start on the growing season. So if the water temperatures are warming and you're up and out of the gravel and swimming sooner, that means you're going to get a head start on the growing season, then you actually might benefit from higher temperatures. The As I say here, the higher spring temperatures will be favorable for growth. However, once you get to the summertime, the temperatures become so high that the fish are not adapted to these kinds of temperatures, and their growth rates will suffer because they're just physiologically, they just can't cope with temperatures that are getting up into the mid to upper 60s, sometimes even low 70s. However, the species that will benefit from those higher temperatures are going to include a lot of our native warm water species, such as the various minnows, such as like red side shiner or dace, suckers, and other native fishes that usually live in the lower part of the river. So I'm thinking that in terms of the fish communities, those species that are already fairly well adapted to warm water will probably prosper in the future, and it's going to get tougher and tougher for the salmon and trout. Currently, we don't have a big non-native species problem in the Snoqualmie, like they do, say, in the Columbia, where they have smallmouth bass, shad, walleyes, bullheads, and catfish, and all kinds of non-native species, which have basically taken over the lower Columbia River. That's not an issue in the Snoqualmie yet. Hopefully that'll stay that way and people won't start putting them in there. The higher summer temperatures, though, are going to be really problematic for migrating adults that come in early in the spawning cycle. And those include spring chinook and summer steelhead, probably the two most popular game fish sport fish species that we've got up there, because when they come in, they're in really good shape. But those high summer temperatures are going to be problematic for them because they have to hold in the lower river during the summertime before they can spawn. The effects of precipitation and discharge are probably going to be that the higher precipitation and discharge in November is going to cause a problem. If you look back over the last, I don't think we have to go back more than 3 or 4 years, we've had no fewer than 3 really significant storm events that have all taken place in that late November, early December period that have caused very large-scale flooding in western Washington. When that happens, you get channel mobilizing events, the gravel start to move, the cobbles start bouncing around, debris flows happen, and you have large wood coming down the streams that scour the bottom. All of those things are harmful to egg survival. So we're going to see problems particularly for some of those early fall spawners like fall chinook and spring chinook. The lower precipitation and discharge in December and January are probably not going to be a problem for the eggs, since they're going to be in the gravel and they'll be fairly safe during those periods. But for fish that need to move out of the main river into riverine ponds, oxbows, beaver ponds, and the places where fish like to spend the wintertime, are going to have problems getting to them because of the lower flows and the fact that the floodplain, particularly in the lower Snoqualmie, has largely been disconnected because of the system of levees and dikes along the edge. Earlier spring runoff, again, will probably favor some fish that tend to migrate to the ocean early. Things like pinks and chums, as soon as they're up and out of the gravel, they spend no more usually than 3 or 4 days in freshwater before they're out of the system. So the earlier spring runoff will probably be beneficial to pinks and chums. However, those fish that tend to migrate late in the spring migration cycle, the juveniles, are going to, the ones that migrate late may have problems, and those include things like steelhead, fall chinook, and coho. The lower flows will probably not help them. The other thing is that this whole shift to an earlier spring runoff is going to move fish out of the system sooner in the year, and many of these migration periods are timed to correspond to nearshore blooms of plankton that happen when the nearshore ocean currents shift and we start getting coastal upwelling, and that drives the whole ocean productivity cycle along the coast. California current shifts, you start to get more intensified upwelling of cold nutrient-rich waters offshore and plankton blooms. And many of the smolt migration cycles are timed to correspond with these plankton blooms. Well, if the fish are flushed from the system too soon, they'll get out there too soon, and the food won't be ready for them when they get out there. The lower summer flows are certainly going to squeeze the fish in terms of available rearing space. And that will happen all the way up to the headwaters, because with lower summer flows, what we're likely to see is a shrinkage of the permanent drainage network. Instead of having perennial flows and many streams that currently flow all year long, we're now likely to start seeing intermittent flows in those headwater streams. And what that will do is force the fish downstream. It will cram more fish into less space and create opportunities for competition. And then finally, lower summer and early fall flows will hinder adult migrations in drought years and may actually cause some mortality. If you've followed the story, for example, of Chinook salmon in the Klamath River, you'll know that over the last 10 years or so, there's been significant mortality of adult Chinook in the lower Klamath because of a combination of lower flows, higher temperature, and disease outbreaks. And these have been just absolutely brutal on Chinook that have been holding in the lower Klamath River waiting for the first fall rains to arrive so they can head up and spawn. So I'm guessing that there are probably going to be winning and losing strategies for the fish as the climate continues to evolve. The winning strategies will include being a habitat generalist. That means you have the ability in your system to be able to adapt to different kinds of habitats. You're not just locked into one type. For example, sockeye pretty much rear in lakes. Well, there aren't any lakes in the Snoqualmie, but certainly we've got a big one right out here in Lake Washington. I'm guessing that the sockeye are probably going to have trouble as the climate continues to change because they don't have any other place to go, and if Lake Washington warms up, that's going to be a problem for them. Another winning strategy is don't hang around in fresh water any longer than you have to, because the conditions here are going to continue to deteriorate. High stray rates. That means that adults, when they come back, don't always go back to the stream of their origin, that they may stray to other river systems. And during a time when you have particularly low flows during drought years or even during flood years, being able to spread the risk over several river systems may be advantageous. The shorter that you're exposed to high and potentially lethal temperatures, the better. So winning strategies mean you don't have to stick around where it's hot. And then I think spring spawning is going to be favored over fall spawning because the possibility of getting caught in one of those big November, early December floods will go down, I think. So it will probably be advantageous to those species that spawn in the spring. So if you were to array the risks from a range of low to high and basically put the fish into bins, and this is just my own guess as to where they would fall in terms of risk to future climate changes, I think those at the highest the highest risk category would include sockeye salmon for the reason that I said. I think the higher temperatures are going to be problematic for this lake-dwelling species. Coho salmon, which usually spends 1 to 2 years in fresh water and is heavily dependent on riverine and off-channel and near riverine habitats. Spring Chinook, which are going to have to face that summer low flow, high temperature block in the lower river, and summer steelhead for the same reason. I also think there's going to be a moderate risk group that has some of these winning strategies as well as a few losing strategies. These are pink and chum salmon. They're fall spawners, so they're going to be vulnerable to these big storms, but they don't spend much time in fresh water, so they may actually do okay. And in fact, these two species, pinks and chums, are currently the two healthiest species in the system. Fall Chinook don't spend much time in fresh water. They're usually there for only about 2 to 3 months before they head out, as opposed to spring Chinook that spend at least a year in fresh water. And then finally, winter steelhead, which I think will probably do better than summer steelhead because their migration timing isn't in the summer. They don't come in and face the high temperatures in the summer. They come in the fall and winter time, and I think they'll be less vulnerable to adult mortality. And then I actually have one species that I'm going to put in the low-risk category, and that's because I think it's a survivor, and that's the cutthroat trout. If you go out here to one of your urban streams like Thornton Creek or some of the others and do a fish survey, what will you find? You'll find cutthroat trout, a species that's been able to live in some highly altered conditions. And cutthroat trout are remarkably generalized as far as their habitat needs go. They can live in just about anything. And so I think even though it's not the most abundant fish in the system, I think it's the one that's going to be one of the best able to cope with climate change in the long run. So if you're working for the Forest Service or any other land management agency, what can you do to deal with climate change and its effect? Well, the first one's sort of a no-brainer, and we've already paid a lot of attention to that, and that's maintaining healthy, well-shaded riparian areas to keep the water temperatures down. So that one, I think, is pretty well recognized. The second one, I think, probably needs a little more work. If you think of the forest, among other things, as one very large sponge, then you start to ask yourself the question, what can you do to the forest to help it capture and retain as much water as possible and slowly bleed it out during the summertime when the flows are going to go down? So those low summer flows and high temperatures during that time, I think it's going to be important to maintain a forest that captures and stores cool water. So how could you do that? Well, one thing you can ask yourself is, what sort of stand structure could you have out there that promotes the capture of fog? For example, one of the potential, and this there's a lot of uncertainty on this one, but one of the potential impacts of climate change is that the land is going to heat up faster than the ocean. So you have a relatively warm land mass adjacent to a somewhat cooler water mass. And what happens there is when you get the right wind conditions, you can get a lot of fog. So among other things, one or two of the climate models are actually predicting an increase in fog. Well, if that's the case, how can you capture the moisture in the fog? Fog drip can be actually a pretty important source of water input during the dry season, basically. And if you had a forest structure with a high leaf area index, and that might include sort of tall, limby trees like you get in mature or late successional forest stands, you can, and with lots of moss and things like that, you can capture a heck of a lot of water. So that's one way you can store water. The other is to reduce the rain on snow effect associated with large forest openings. And I imagine you probably had several seminars that have dealt with this one, but areas with big clear cuts tend to hold the snow right there easily, where warm rains can fall on it, and the whole works melts, and you get high levels of runoff. So those are two things that you might think about if you're trying to design a forest that acts like a big healthy sponge. The third one is to disconnect the road drainage from the stream network. In many cases, the road ditches, the runoff, the places where the water runs off during storms next to logging roads, can be those that are connected directly to the streams. In other words, the ditch runs right down next to the road and just dumps into the stream. Well, in some places with high road densities, a large ditch network can effectively double your effective drainage length. And that can be very important during intense storms because those ditches convey water very quickly from the watersheds down to the stream network, and that can result in some relatively high peaks. So this is disconnecting the road drainage from the stream network is one way to kind of help knock the top off some of those peaks that you get during those intense fall storms. The fourth one is to, again, and I think this is a no-brainer because we've all talked about this, is to, where you have the opportunity, reconnect the stream with its associated seasonal habitats. Things like floodplains, riverine ponds and the like. These are very important seasonal habitats for fish. They may not be used all year long, but they're used part of the year. And being able to get from the river network, from the river system to these seasonal habitats is very important. And then finally, and this one I think is one that's probably underappreciated right now, is that springs and seeps represent some of our most important seasonal water treasures. Large springs are going to be excellent sources of cool, clean, well-buffered water throughout the year. And right now, for example, my agency, the Forest Service, does not have a comprehensive inventory of large springs. And it should. And so should all the other land managers, because there's going to be a big run on springs as the climate continues to change. And it's not just for other uses. I mean, as things like the bottled water industry is very interested in springs. So it's important to protect springs and seeps from water appropriation and also the kinds of land development that can affect them, because these are going to be very important water sources as the climate continues to change. And I think, yep, that's my last one, so I would be, how am I doing for time? Yep, we got about 10 minutes. Be happy to answer any questions. The question was, if I can paraphrase a little, how representative is the Snoqualmie of many of the other river basins in this region? Well, the Snoqualmie, in one sense, is a bit of a hybrid river system hydrologically, because it has snow, it has some one peak in the spring corresponding to snow melt, and another one corresponding to the winter storm. So it's a rainfall and snow melt dominated system. There are some river systems in the region that are almost primarily rainfall driven hydrographs, like the Chehalis. The Chehalis River is a classic example of one of those. But there are others on the Olympic Peninsula that originate in the Olympic Mountains that are probably not too far off. And so this one's fairly representative of some of the of many of the Western Cascade Mountain river systems and some parts of the Olympic Peninsula. But in the sort of the glacial outwash areas of southwestern Washington, where you don't have a significant winter snowpack, there's quite a bit of difference there. Good question. The question was, does the fact that our agency doesn't have a spring inventory correspond to the lack of information on groundwater, surface water? I don't know if I can, that's good. I don't know if I can answer that with certainty. It's just that I think that somehow springs weren't perceived as being that important to the agency from a natural resource standpoint. And so when folks were going through doing their timber cruises and road surveys and so forth, they never bothered to note them. So they never got into anybody's maps or geographic systems. And one of the things that we're pressing for now that we have more sophisticated remote sensing technologies is to start to look for these things. Using tools such as forward-looking infrared and other things that would enable us to cover large areas. But, you know, it's not easy to hike around in a lot of these wilderness areas and try to locate springs. Nevertheless, they're important nodes of biodiversity. And as I said, from a water standpoint, these things are regional treasures. Let me give you an example. They just discovered a couple of years ago a 90 CFS spring in central Oregon on the east side. It was in the headwaters of Oregon's Deschutes River. Nobody even knew it was there, but yeah, that's a lot of water. And I'm sure that some bottled water company would love to be able to tap into that. And it's important to identify those so we can get some protection on them before they get too developed.
What effect has the road decommissioning had on this whole picture?
Yeah. The question was, what effect has road decommissioning had climate impacts on these? Probably too soon to tell, because for the most part, even though the Forest Service has decommissioned quite a bit of road, I think probably in the range of 5,000 to 10,000 miles of road in Washington, the total amount of road decommissioned, and we're talking about full decommissioning, where they refill the grade and slope it and plant it and do all the things that they do, is relatively small. In many cases, we've got a lot of dead roads out there that aren't open anymore that have never been decommissioned. So the percent of those that have been actively decommissioned is probably still so small it's lost in the noise. It's hard to detect yet, if that answers your question. Wish we had a bigger signature, but right now the overall amount of road decommissioned is probably not large enough to be able to separate that signal from the rest of the environmental noise. Particularly because, like I say, there's a lot of dead roads out there that are still causing problems.
What are the trends to see in fish now? You know, you're talking about the future, but we've obviously been monitoring these things for some time.
So. Yeah. The trends continue to be down for most species. Let's see if I go through them. Chinook are trending somewhat downward in Puget Sound. Steelhead are trending downward significantly, not only in Puget Sound, but on the coast as well. Steelhead are not doing well now. Coho are, they've had their ups and downs. The signal isn't clear. Pinks and chums seem to be doing okay. They're predicting one of the largest pink runs ever this next fall. So those species seem to be doing all right. Bull trout are holding their own because, among other things, we put a lot of environmental protections in for bull trout. So they're doing better. And I think cutthroat trout are probably doing all right. So the biggest risks now are probably to Chinook salmon, steelhead, and coho. Those are the three species that are probably in the most significant downward trend. I don't think we're seeing a significant... Oh, and sockeye. Lake Washington sockeye aren't doing very well either. I should have mentioned that one. But I don't know of any species that's actually shown a positive trend. They've had annual ups and downs, but they tend to be pinks and chums seem to be fairly stable, and cutthroat I think probably fairly stable. But one of the reasons for that is that the state has instituted a lot more conservative harvest restrictions on those.
All right, so we're almost out of time. So thanks a lot.